Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission.
I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a fascinating conversation with Professor Sean Duffy at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland. Professor Duffy specializes in the history of medieval Ireland, the political history of Ireland, from the Viking Age to the Bruce invasion, Irish relations with England, Scotland, and Wales in the same period, and the history of the archaeology of medieval Dublin. Come along and join Professor Duffy at Trinity College, Dublin, Ireland.
I'm Professor of Medieval History here in Trinity College, Dublin. So it's mostly medieval is what I do. I've written a history of Ireland called Ireland in the Middle Ages. I edited an atlas of Irish history. One of the areas that I specialise in is medieval Dublin. So every year here in Trinity we have a medieval Dublin conference, and I produce a volume called Medieval Dublin. And we've done 11 of them now at this stage. They do history and archaeology of Dublin down through the years. The 11th century and in the 12th century, the belief was that Ireland had lost all of that earlier greatness, and that the Irish Church had gone backward, and that it wasn't any longer in conformity with the way the Latin Church should be. Something needed to be done with this in order to save their souls. But to what extent that was a genuine Christian ideal or merely an attempt to get greater uniformity within the church so that the churchmen could dominate other churches that they thought were out of step with them. It's debatable.
That's the period when the parish system came in?
Yes, and all sorts of other things that the Catholic Church, of course, today tells us have been there since the days of Christ. Like a celibate clergy. You know, a clergy, priests not marrying. In Ireland, priests continued to marry and have wives and children. And that is the way the Christian Church had been for 1,000 years. But in the 11th century, it was decided that they shouldn't, that they should remain celibate. And the main reason, to be honest, of course, as we all know, is because the church had vast estates. And if a priest had a wife and children, the children had to be provided for. So the chances were the estates, the church lands, would get siphoned off to feed his children. So if you kept your priest single, he had no wife, he had no children, you could make sure you held on to those lands, and it was cheaper to maintain. But in Ireland, that's not the way it worked. In Ireland, priests continued to get married and to have children, and therefore that was perceived to be an aberration. It's also the case, for instance, the Christian Church, for the first 1,000 years of it, divorce was normal. It was a very common thing. A marriage was not for life, and that's the way that it stayed in Ireland throughout the Middle Ages. But in the 11th and 12th century, the papacy was saying, I'm sorry, marriage is for life. You can't get divorced. Polygamy had been practiced in the Christian Church. That was being stamped out. At least in certain sections of Irish society in the 11th and 12th centuries, some of the top people were probably polygamous, or possibly polygamous.
Going back to 6th century, say, the monastic period, do you think that, like Skellig Michael, do you think they were the highest searching for this purest approach to monastic lifestyle? Polygamy would not be an operative in their mindset.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's certainly the case. The Irish did have this very noble commitment to Christian church when they were converted to it, and lots of examples of this kind of extreme asceticism on the part of Irish clergy, a desire to escape from the worldly wealth and so on, escape to a desert-like existence. And that's what you get in most of the Irish, great Irish monasteries started out that way. You know, a place like Glenloch is up in the mountains and it's remote from the world. And that was the idea. But the same with all the history of the Christian church has been that some people do that and some people therefore, and then they inspire everyone else by that. But we're not going to give our lives over to that kind of ascetic idea. Mm-hmm. We'll give them what we have, which is money and wealth. And so these churchmen who turned their back on wealth to become poor, to get to God that way, end up having been patronized by getting the patronage and the benefaction of wealthy powers. And they therefore become rich. Like, so all of these Irish monasteries that were idealistic retreats from the world become, in fact, great centers of wealth over time. And therefore, they do become corrupt. Mm-hmm. So in escaping from the world, you get called back to it again, you know, and trapped by it. And that is certainly the case in Ireland.
At that period of time in those monastic communities, isn't it true that there was a civilian or a non-religious element of the ownership of those places?
Yes, it's a difficult one to get our heads around, but it seems to have been the case that in Ireland, everything was hereditary. You know, so power in among kings was hereditary, but power among churchmen was hereditary as well. So the families who were the descendants of the early monastic founders maintained a presence there, maintained a grip on the top jobs, maintained ownership of the lands, and they developed these offices which were hereditary keepers of the monastic estate.
So an abbot, there might not be a priest in the sense.
It seems to have been the case that for a period, a lot of these people weren't actually even properly trained in the church. But it's also the case, of course, that that is not untypical. That is the way elsewhere. You know, when the Anglo-Normans, for instance, came to Ireland in the late 12th century, the people that they appointed to run the church in their new colony in Ireland were effectively civil servants of the crown who were rewarded for their loyalty to the king and for all of the diplomatic activity and judicial activity and administrative activity that they did for the king. They were rewarded with a bishopric. Some of them were not in holy orders, not even a priest when they became a bishop. Now, they might eventually become a priest, but in many cases they were just bureaucrats. And so it's a bit hypocritical for them to complain of the outlandishness of the Irish church when they were, you know, corrupt themselves.
Pre-11th century, in the early church hierarchy structure in Ireland, when Armagh would be the ecclesiastic center, were they the overlords or the ruling center for the whole country? Was there a sense of being checked up on and hierarchical structure there? Or was it free and independent wherever you were in Ireland?
It's not entirely. Ireland had a large number of churches established around the country. But obviously, these churches were quite closely associated with the main dynastic powers. In other words, every major political dynasty had a major church that was associated with it. Now, throughout the second half of the first millennium, say from, you know, 500 AD to 1000 AD, the leading power in Ireland were the northern dynasty known as the Éineann. The church that was most closely associated with them was Armagh. You know, if you are a king, you're a powerful king, you want a powerful church associated with you, and that you patronize that and you give it great wealth. As you are elevated, it's elevated, and vice versa. For as long as the Éineann were the dominant political power in Ireland, they needed a dominant political church to be their ecclesiastical counterpart, and that was Armagh. And it is the case, therefore, that, you know, in Ireland, it was largely recognised that Armagh was, it was the see that was associated with St. Patrick, and St. Patrick was widely recognised as the patron, you know, of the founder of the Irish church.
That was a question for you. In that original sourcing of writing exists, supposedly, about the legend of St. Patrick, it was used intentionally as a power play tool for the apostolic primacy.
Yeah.
Of Armagh, true?
Oh, yes,
that it
yes.
was like that St. Patrick was used, right?
Yes, that, true. Doesn't mean that St. Patrick didn't exist.
Exactly. But subsequently, they wanted to claim and,
Yeah. You can imagine, you know, a situation where if the Church of Armagh wants to extend its status and its authority throughout the island, and it is linked with St. Patrick. So, but the way, therefore, to extend Armagh's influence is to try to make everybody in the country think that St. Patrick himself had exercised some kind of jurisdiction in all of these other parts of the country. And therefore, as they're able to convince people of this, of Patrick's presence in their locality, they're able to get those people to accept Armagh's authority in those localities. So if you take that to its logical conclusion, they had to try to prove to every town and village and rural, most rural parts of Ireland, that St. Patrick had been there and had converted there and had established a church there. And that meant that those people, when they accepted St. Patrick in the 5th century, they must now accept Armagh in the 9th or the 10th or the 11th century.
That perfectly fits with my next question, which is a what-if question. Because they did, and if they had not, you know, that differential, because they did, that's to a large extent what has made St. Patrick live on as this bigger-than-life saint legend forever and revered, to the point that you have to remind people that he wasn't even Irish.
Yes, I mean, it is ironic, isn't it, that on the 17th of March, the entire world becomes Irish for the day to remember a Brit, you know, somebody who came from Britain.
Yes, yeah.
It is very strange, you know, but, you know, that's the way, because he has been fully embraced by the Irish, obviously. And let's remember that when we talk of St. Patrick being British, we don't mean British in the sense of being English, because he was, you know, a British Celt, if you like, a descendant of the original cousins of the Irish who inhabited our beloved sister island before the Anglo-Saxons even arrived into England. So in that sense, he had a cultural affinity with the Irish, even if he wasn't ethnically Irish as such.
In the first millennium, latter part, I've read that the Irish had colonized parts of Wales, probably near where he hailed from.
Yes, I mean, the Irish, we like to think of ourselves as being an oppressed people who are the victims of invasion and conquest. But, you know, this, we live on this archipelago. There are two big islands, as I was saying, and there's toing and froing between the two islands, so it worked in both directions. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact is, for instance, Scotland is Scotland, the land of the Scots, and the original Scotty were the people the Romans called Scotty were the Irish. The Irish conquered northern Britain, and it became an Irish colony. And there were further Irish colonies in, as you say, Wales, and even in Devon and Cornwall.
And how about Iona? Could you speak to that for a moment?
Yes, well, Iona, of course, is a tiny little island off a slightly larger island off the west coast of Scotland. And because it's so remote, an Irish aristocrat, St. Columbkiller or St. Columba, went there in the middle of the 6th century to escape from the world and set up his own little kind of a community there. But that was at the time when the Irish were colonising the western seaboard of what is now Scotland. Some of his political associates would have been doing this. So over the course of time, that little deserted island and almost hermitage-like settlement became a centre of political influence because it was associated with this new wave of Irish dynasts in northwestern Britain. And for that reason, then, its influence began to spread and over throughout Scotland. So in other words, as these Irish colonists in northern Britain gained political ascendancy, these Irish churchmen in northern Britain gained ecclesiastical ascendancy and then started to spread down, as you know, down to Lindisfarne and in what is now England, and subsequently then to the continent, to re-evangelize in the continent.
Would it be fair to surmise that, like the Old English being absorbed into the ascendancy that go back in that first millennium, that the Irish who colonized in Scotland eventually were absorbed and became a part of that culture, rather than kind of dissipated as a colonial?
Yeah, well, it's a very strange process. I mean, we don't know entirely how it worked. But obviously, when the Irish colonized northern Britain, they found different peoples there when they arrived, and including these people that are called the Picts, kind of seem to have more or less vanished. But when a kingdom of Scotland emerged in the 8th and 9th centuries, that kingdom was primarily a Gaelic kingdom. You know, the language that they spoke, the culture that they practiced, and the political structures and so on that they had were inherited from Ireland. So, you know, in many respects, it was no different from Ireland and was considered by the Irish to be an Irish province. Now, obviously, as you know, it went its separate way eventually, because there were so many different influences in Scotland, because there were, it was subject to Anglo-Saxon invasions as well. It was then subjected to Scandinavian invasion by the Vikings, and then later, of course, by Normans and others. So Scotland is a very complicated picture. Mm-hmm. Ireland tends to be in the Middle Ages a lot more black and white than Scotland. But, you know, for most of the Middle Ages, until you get towards the end of the Middle Ages, the dominant political ethos in what we call Scotland now was an Irish one, was a Gaelic-Irish one, inherited from these Irish colonists.
Let's jump forward to the ascendancy. Let's go to the plantation of Ulster. And now the powers that be are inviting Scots to come and homestead. But they're inviting people who are of a Celtic tradition and background to come when you have the Normans and the English. And I remember reading some place that in some ways a closer affinity among the Scots to the Irish than to the British. And so in some ways they became a pain in the side to the Brits. Talk to that for a moment.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is complicated, needless to say. It is very complicated. But it is the case that the part of Ireland, it's quite ironic that the part of Ireland today that is still in the United Kingdom is the part of Ireland that throughout the Middle Ages was the most Irish, was the most Gaelic. And of course, that explains why it's British today, because it had to be stamped out, that Irishness, in the 17th century. And it was decided that the only way to keep it subjected to British rule and keep it British was to dilute the native Irish population with new settlements, new plantations, in the same way that it was done in North America. But when they went looking for these people, a lot of the people that they brought over were not people from England, they were people from Scotland. And some, not all by any means, but some of those Scottish people who were brought over were actually the descendants of Irish people who had settled in Scotland, you know, hundreds of years earlier. You know, many of them, in a sense, were returning home. Now, to tell them that now, if I were to tell them that they are actually more Irish than the Irish themselves, because they were Irish people who colonized Northern Britain and then returned to Ireland a millennium later, and that makes them the original Irish, you know, I'm not sure how welcome that would be among them. But I suppose it is undoubtedly the case.
Yeah.
But it does mean, therefore, that if you scratch deep enough among the peoples who inhabit these few little islands here, I mean, ultimately, let's face it, the gene pool is very blended at this stage. And so it is silly for us to think that there are any kind of fixed boundaries ethnically or genetically between any of us, you know.
Let's extrapolate and jump forward a little bit and talk about what's called the Scots-Irish in America and the emigration. And I want to address two issues. One is Presbyterianism as a second-class citizen in the British hierarchy right above the Catholics. And number two, the Gaelic-Irish condition or equation within the Scots-Irish as being driving them off the country to the New World.
Again, none of these things are ever that simple, but it is, I suppose it is the case that many of the people that we tend to call the Scots-Irish today arrived in Ireland from Scotland in the 17th century and attempted to put a roots down in Ireland. But one of the biggest difficulties with the new dispensation in the northern part of Ireland in the 17th century is that this new plantation was never complete. The plan was literally to move all of the Irish off from Ulster and then to settle an entirely new population there. In reality, it was much more spotty than that, and it was there were lots of Irish stayed there. And so for many of these new people who had come to Ireland to establish a new home here, it became after a while, as you know, it wasn't the El Dorado it had been thought it would be. And so they're the people then who were quite restless and eventually headed across the Atlantic to America and decided to put down roots there. And so, of course, they were very formative in the early stages of the colonizing stages in America, having cut their teeth in Ireland. So they were old hands at it.
Let's dovetail back to Presbyterianism for a moment, because that, from my reading, is an operative in what drove off quite a few of the Scots-Irish to come to the New World.
Yes, I mean, as you said yourself, I mean, in many respects, they were as looked down upon as much as their Roman Catholic neighbours were. And of course, one of the great tragedies, I suppose, of modern Irish history has been that the those things that the Presbyterians and Roman Catholics had in common, or were perceived to have in common, in the 17th and the 18th century, later on came to divide them when the Irish Catholics began to get emancipation. And the perception rose amongst Presbyterians that, in fact, instead of the Catholics being their fellows against the established church, they, the Catholics, were the ones who posed the real threat to the position of the Presbyterians, and they were pushed apart, they were forced apart. But as you know, in the late 18th century in Ireland, this organisation, the United Irishmen, that rebelled in 1798, was an organisation that was, the leadership of which was largely Presbyterian, and was seeking to unite all Irish people, Catholic, Protestant, and Dissenter, which was their great battle cry, if you like, to unite them.
Let me interrupt for a moment, because that's another question of mine, has to do with the rebellion of 1798, a rebellion that's been painted as a massacre, not that it's technically justifiable, but as a reaction to years and centuries of abuse, it almost seems in a human nature a natural reaction.
Yes, I suppose. It has to be said that the 1798 rebellion was these were the events of one summer, and there was bloodshed on both sides, and essentially, it was a kind of a desperate attempt by the Irish to get by a military insurrection what they had failed to get for the preceding centuries by any other means. So
if that had not happened, it might have driven policies differently.
Well, the 1798 rebellion, to be honest, the root of that is in many respects lies in very recent events, in America, the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. They looked at that and they saw what they managed to achieve. And they looked to France then as well, and they tried to embrace the ideals of the French revolutionaries and overthrowing these kind of old-fashioned monarchies and get a more egalitarian society. Mm-hmm. So I think while there were atrocities committed in Ireland in 1798, the leadership of that were people of great idealism. By any definition would be considered today to be, heroes. And like the leaders of the American Revolution are viewed.
By 1800, 1801, right here in the Parliament, there were really abusive, restrictive laws that were put into place that set things horribly backwards, correct?
In Ireland, especially after the Williamite revolution in Ireland, in order to penalise Catholics, there were these penal laws, as they're called, put in place, which were very restrictive on the rights of Catholics. And the vast majority of the Irish population, of course, were Roman Catholic. And so there were huge disabilities placed against them. And but the aftermath of the 1798 rebellion, the Irish Parliament was entirely removed. It was decided that by the British government at the time that the only way to ensure that Ireland would stay subject was to deny it a parliament that would govern its own affairs.
They had to go to London Parliament after that, correct?
Yes, and so in the year 1800 they abolished the Parliament. Our national parliament was just across the road from us now, and the Parliament building was taken away and it was given to a bank, and it remains a bank. And we're going to have to get it back from that bank, because the Irish experience at the hands of bankers in recent years has not been a good one. But so in the 19th century, the main movement in Ireland was the Home Rule movement, which was designed to get us back our parliament so that we could govern our own affairs. Mm-hmm. And of course, that is the movement that eventually led to the Easter Rebellion in 1916, when But certain people obviously decided that, again, as was the case in 1798, that there was no point in looking for half-hearted measures, because you might as well go the whole hog and try. The only way you can get, the view was, the only way you can get from your oppressors, you know, what you're entitled to is just to give them what mm-hmm. they've been giving you down mm-hmm. through the years.
Yeah. But again, even though the rising of 1916 and a lot of people have said the attacking of the post office was an incredibly illogical strategic move, and there were some awful things that were done during that time. My reading is that it's a classic example of the incredibly insane reaction of, what was it, General Maxwell or, and the British. What they did to the Irish people indiscriminately was a death knell for them. And if they had not, things might not have unraveled for them. Is that true?
Yes, yeah. And of course, it's the oldest story in the book, isn't it? Every, you know, dominant power in the world has tended, when it's lost its power, it tends to have lost its power not because it gradually slipped away, but because of a reaction against an overzealous pursuit of power by them. So here in Ireland, the rebellion that began in Easter 1916 was by a small number of people who were mostly poets. You know, they weren't soldiers, they had no idea about how to conduct a military campaign. But the problem was, and there was limited Irish support for what they were doing, because most Irish people believed we were just about to get our parliament back, home rule, which had been our main demand. And that these young men and women in 1916, you know, decided to go for broke and look for an independent republic. And it might have been quashed and put down, and that would have been the end of the story. Had it not been for, as you say, this General Maxwell and the general British overreaction to it, which obviously had the effect then people were just aghast, you know, horrified by the reaction and the execution of these poets.
Mm-hmm. There was even some indiscriminate stuff. A Dubliner I talked to, he said his parents told a story of neighbor boys were yanked out of their house and disappeared, never came back. They don't even know what happened.
In the aftermath of the rising, when there was a gradual heightening of support for the revolutionaries, that tended to drift into effectively an all-out war. We call it the War of Independence here. But there were a lot of atrocities committed to it during that as well, and on the British part. Now, we should remember, of course, that this is during the Great War, the First World War. Ireland was part of the United Kingdom, and the perception in Britain was that these Irish people who were British citizens were traitors. You know, your country is at war against a great enemy.
Politically, wasn't that used as another tool to call them treasonous activity, even though it was a domestic issue? They dovetailed under the War Acts.
Yes, I mean it was, but some of the reprisals and some of the British unwillingness to accept what the Irish were doing was certainly caused by the stresses of war, because the feeling was that these Irish were stabbing them in the back. From the Irish point of view, the Irish had learned over the centuries, we have this old saying that England's difficulty is Ireland's opportunity. And so that for the people who rose up in the rebellion, their view, of course, was that England was distracted elsewhere. Now is our chance.
Right.
We're never going to get as good a chance. Irish people, most of the Irish people involved in the rising, didn't consider it treason on their part. Mm-hmm. They consider it a bid for freedom. Depending on your perspective, you can take a different view on these things. And the view, obviously, there were rights and wrongs on both sides. But mm-hmm. most people in the world think, I believe, that a small country's bid for freedom is more noble than that of a big neighbor trying to dominate the affairs of its neighbors.
I need to jump around because, are we okay on time?
Or? Okay, yeah, sure. Yeah, I haven't done about half two. So
okay. Let's jump back for a moment to 1601 Battle of Kinsale. And it's a couple, again, what if questions. Number one, it's the why part is, why did O'Neill and everybody have to come down all the way from the north and wear themselves out marching across the country? Number one. Number two, why did the Spanish not respond to the signal to come out and help?
Well, I mean, you know, as with all of these military campaigns, the history of the world is littered with mistakes and tactical blunders and errors and so on. The background to that, of course, is that there was this Irish rebellion in the last years of Queen Elizabeth's reign of the 16th century, and that rebellion was mostly focused in Ulster, because Ulster had been the part of Ireland that had been least affected by the English presence since the time of the original Norman invasion, and it stayed most Gaelic. But the Spanish Catholic aid that arrived in Ireland landed at the absolute opposite part of the country to them.
And why? That's what I don't understand. Why did they come down to Kinsale?
Well, it's part just pure geography. You know, if you're travelling from Spain, you hit southern Ireland before you hit the northern part of Ireland. But there was local Irish support there as well, to a lesser extent. But the great leaders of the Irish support were in the north. So the only thing for it seemed to them at the time was to march south and join forces with them. And they had been used to, traditionally, the Irish armies had been used to marching considerable distances. So whilst it was ambitious, it was possible, and it was done. But, you know, there was and it might well have gone in the other way. These battles sometimes do. Mm-hmm. But it's unlikely to have, it was always unlikely, I think, that the events of that rebellion would end up other than the way that they did. I would incline to the view that if you look at the Ireland's relationship with England in the preceding centuries, it was always heading towards a situation where England would give some attention to Ireland for a long enough period to complete a conquest that it had begun in the late 12th century. All they needed to do was just to bring sufficient numbers of troops, pump sufficient money into it, and stay focused on it for a sufficiently long period, and it was doable. And it's just that never happened before this. And in those last years of the 16th century, during the reign of Queen Elizabeth, the time and the effort and the money was available, and the leadership was available, and so they pumped those resources in. And I think that rebellion was doomed from the start. Now, the consequences of it mightn't have been the way they were. I mean, what happened at the end of it was that, for some reason, unknown only to themselves, the great leaders of that Irish rebellion, O'Neill and O'Donnell, ultimately decided that there was no future for them in Ireland, and they sailed off to the continent.
That's my question, the flight of the Earls. Why? Was it because they knew they would just be devastated and basically homeless in the end if they stayed? Was it self-preservation? Because the myth is that they were become exiles and then they would return, which never happened.
It should be remembered that many of those men who went off during the flight of the Earls and its aftermath did quite well for themselves on the continent. They went, for the most part, to the Catholic powers of Europe. They were treated like, you know, emigre refugees, like royal refugees that we've seen throughout the 20th century, for instance, when a monarchy loses, a king is deposed, and another country finds a home for him. Some of them, their descendants are there today in Spain and Portugal in particular. You can see the big estates, they were granted aristocratic titles, and they've done well for themselves, probably better than they might have been able to do in Ireland. Mm-hmm. But as you say, for some of them, it was intended to go and return.
Do you think there's truth to that? Do you think that they did, in an ideal sense, hope that they could come back and even for self-serving purposes, restore their ownership of their lands and castles?
I think that is the case. Some of them did intend to come back. Some of them did attempt to come back. And there were always movements to secure their restoration throughout the 17th century. But it became, the longer they were away, the harder that became. And the more fixed the new plantation regime became, the greater the obstacles that were in the way of Gaelic recovery or Catholic recovery, especially in Ulster. So it did become one of those great landmarks, you know, where the kind of Gaelic civilization that had been in power in Ireland for 1,000 years was brought to an end, and that part of Ireland that had been the bastion of Gaelicness became the new hard center of a British loyalty in Ireland.
Going back in time a little bit, if there had not been power plays between Leinster and Munster and whatnot, and they had all said, let's form this unified alliance, and we're talking a lot earlier, things might have been different for the whole last millennium, right?
Yes, undoubtedly that's the case. The Irish were never able to unify together. And I think the reason for that is, I suppose it has to do with the way in which Ireland, the kind of society that existed in Ireland, which was this clan-based society, where a person's loyalty was, ultimately, was to their own clan, not to this notion of Ireland. It doesn't mean that they didn't know they were Irish, and they didn't have some kind of idealized view that Ireland might be free or Ireland might be united. But the reality on the ground was that it was every man for himself. Mm. And so each, the country was divided up into political dynasties whose biggest enemy was never the distant rule from Westminster. It was always the guy down the road. So in asking for a unity like that among them, you're really asking for something that was beyond, you know, normal people.
And so that's really an underlying huge issue in how and why the last 1,000 years evolved or devolved the way they did. Isn't that true?
Yes, I suppose. You know, it's inevitable. It's very easy for us to look back, you know, with the benefit of hindsight and to say that they should have done this. If only they'd done that, things might have been different. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we have to face the situation as it was. Even the original Anglo-Norman invasion of Ireland didn't meet with anything like a unified response from the Irish, because people, even today, people are preoccupied with their immediate goal. When the Anglo-Normans stepped ashore on Ireland in the 12th century, they found peoples who were busy competing with each other for power and for land. And if the Anglo-Norman attacked individual A, then individual B, who had been his traditional enemy, said, yippee, that's great news, because he's doing what I've been trying to do for a long time. Mm. They weren't able to stand back from it and say, well, actually, you know, in the longer term, this is bad news.
Right.
They couldn't see that.
Mm-hmm.
That they're human beings, yep. You know.
Time, place, and communication skills and abilities. Let's jump forward for a moment to the Cromwellian incursion, invasion, 1647. And number one, just some insights on Cromwell as a Puritan, as just a zealot, an insane zealot in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, again, the opinion is divided on this. If you were asking somebody in England, they'd think Cromwell was a great man, a wonderful man.
I was in Belfast recently, and there's an end building in a sectarian neighborhood, and it's a giant painting of Cromwell as a hero.
Part of that is true, because England did have this King Charles I in Cromwell's lifetime, who was getting increasingly despotic in his rule. And if you think what Cromwell started off doing, he started off saying, look, you know, how should a country be governed? It should be governed by the people, through Parliament. He was the champion of Parliament who's, you know, ended up executing, but removing from power a despot and instituting a parliamentary dispensation in England. So he's a wonderful hero in terms of the development of,
yes,
the English constitution. But in Ireland, of course, he has a very different reputation, because, as you know, he came to Ireland determined to, once and for all, put an end to Irish opposition to English rule. And he was, of course, virulently anti-Roman. He detested the fact that the Irish had this lingering attachment to Rome. He believed, like a lot of people did in the 17th century, throughout Europe and in the New World, you know, that be ultimately rewarded by God if you extirpated the devil.
He felt he was doing God's work.
Yeah, the devil worked through Rome. Mm-hmm. Rome, you know, this is what people believed then, and many people believed it until compared to, some people probably still do believe it, that the Pope was the Antichrist, literally the Antichrist. And if you think about that, you are going to go to a heavenly reward if you give your life to combating the Antichrist, Rome. And, you know, the Irish people were viewed as followers of the Antichrist. And if you believe that, then there's nothing that you could do to them that isn't good enough for them, you know.
So when he was stabling horses in the churches, that was no issue for him.
Yeah, he was an instrument of God. He believed himself to be, that God was acting through him. So
try and explain the Drogheda that was just a massacre, wanton, incredible destruction. How could he justify that?
He was able to justify that. You know, he believed that these towns were holding out against him. They were holding out against, you know, the force of law, and they were bastions of Romishness, and they had to be made an example of, and great appalling cruelties were committed in Ireland by Cromwell. There's no figure in Irish history that the ordinary Irish person, any Irish person you meet, will tell you there's no villain greater than Cromwell, who literally massacred thousands of Irish people. But again, it's a historian's job to see things through another lens. And from Cromwell's lens, Ireland would never settle down and would never progress and would never prosper until there was a new political and religious order in Ireland. So he believed, in his own mind, that he had to finish a job that had been started by his predecessors. And, you know, finish it he attempted to do. And that involved massacre. It involved, there's this phrase that's ascribed to him, to hell or to Connacht, which you may or may not have said, which essentially meant that, you know, those lingering Irish Roman Catholics had to be dispossessed of their lands and pushed west of the Shannon and resettled in the most barren, mountainous, boggy parts of Ireland, and the good land given for new Protestant settlers in the country.
Let me dovetail back, because that's another question you made me think of, and that's the literal definition historically of the Pale around this town. It was literally a berm and stakes in the ground, and it was delineated by distance?
Yes, I mean, the original Pale was actually a place around Calais. When the English were fighting the Hundred Years' War, they established a pale, a ditch around their enclave that they had in France at Calais. And that idea worked reasonably well for a while, keeping the French out. So they developed this idea here in Ireland in the late 15th century, that since the English colony had more or less shrunk back to the area around Dublin, that maybe one way of preventing it shrinking even further was literally to build a ditch around it, and with a bank and a fence and so on. And that is the origin of this term, beyond the pale. But obviously, with all things like that,
Is there any evidence of where physically that delineated perimeter was at that time?
Yeah, we know large sections of it. Little bits of it still survive. That ditch can still be seen in the field boundaries around the counties that it covered, were Louth, Meath, Dublin and Kildare. And little stretches of it are still there. And legislation that was passed by the Irish Parliament prescribed the extent of it. So it said it should run from here to here to here to here to here, and castles are to be built all along it, and monies were granted by the Irish Parliament for the construction of castles to defend the area inside the Pale from the area beyond it.
And so, and after the Cromwellian incursion and they relocated people, it was the Shannon River, right, that was the delineation point?
Yes, I mean, Cromwell decided that he needed to, it was a bit of a back of the envelope kind of a calculation on his part, but basically the idea was that if there are still going to be these Irish people who are going to be Papists, and we're not going to actually exterminate them, we must remove them. So let's remove them to the least fertile part of Ireland. So let's focus our energies on colonising Ireland east of the Shannon and push the Irish to the west of the Shannon. They did attempt to do that, you know, and there were movements of people west of the Shannon, but it was, most Irish Catholics didn't physically move westwards, they just sunk down the social ladder. So they became the tenants on these new landlords who were established. Mm-hmm. So the problem with that kind of a solution to the situation is that if these people don't go away, then eventually, if they're just there lurking in the Badlands, eventually they will rise up again. And of course, this is what happens.
We're almost out of time, but a really quick question. During the potato famine and the emigration period subsequent to that, there was the poor rate tax. And my understanding is that you as a landlord, it was cheaper for you sometimes to pay the passage and steerage of your tenant farmers and ship them out than to keep them because they weren't generating anything for use. That's true, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this became a phenomenon, and this accounts for a lot of the Irish emigration of the time. It has to be said that one of the consequences of the introduction of the potato into Ireland was that you could feed vastly more people on a vastly smaller piece of land. And so the population of Ireland rose exponentially in the 18th century as a result of the introduction of the potato. We know that most of these Irish tenant farmers had hardly any land, had hardly any livestock. There was little arable land available to them to grow a crop other than potatoes. But as you know, you could feed a large family on a very small plot of land. And so it was undoubtedly a contributory factor. Mm-hmm. And most people survived literally on potatoes and nothing else. The thing about a potato is that it's remarkably nutritious. You know, if you only ate potato and you got no meat or you got no vegetable, you mightn't be the healthiest person in the world, but you could live to adulthood and procreate. And so there was a huge population increase in Ireland. And, you know, I suppose the difficulty was that that was ultimately unsustainable if the potato crop failed. And, you know, the Great Famine was by no means, of course, the first major failing of the crop. There had been warning signs before when there had been a crop failure. There have been other devastating famines that we tend to forget.
Real quick, famine ships and the ones that are historically associated with just incredible deaths, 30-40% sometimes. Is it true that there's a direct correlation again with the British, in that the British Admiralty, their maritime rules and regulations were so much looser than the American vessels that the amount of food they had to feed you and the sanitary conditions almost guaranteed an X amount of deaths on the boats?
Yeah, this is the age of the laissez-faire policy, you know, where the government believed that there should be no intrusion on the rights of capital to make as much money as they possibly could. And, of course, if that meant getting cramming as many people into one of these ships as you possibly could, because they were paying by the head. So undoubtedly that's the case. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a terribly, terribly tragic thing. But, you know, those who made it left their imprint on the other side of the Atlantic, and so they have been. Those who made it went off to a greater life elsewhere, and they haven't done so bad for themselves. Some of them.
Professor Sean Duffy, thank you so much for sharing.
Oh, you're very welcome, Tom. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
Yes, you too. Thank you again, Sean. This is great.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, STEAM, along with studying the legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture. The Foundation at Hearst Castle not only changes the lives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors and members. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundationathearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station.
I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.